guest today is Chris Arnotti, who's a writer and photographer and the author of the book Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America, which is published by Sentinel. His work has also been published in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal, among many other publications. Before that, he worked on Wall Street for 20 years as a trader with Salomon Brothers and Citigroup. Before that, he earned a PhD in physics from Johns Hopkins. And before that, he grew up in the town of San Antonio, Florida. Chris, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. That's a very thorough background.
Good. Being academia and all that. So I wanted to start by asking, thinking about the title of your book and this idea of dignity. One of the things that you discuss is the way, arguably, in America, there's been maybe too much of an emphasis on quantifiable things like GDP and so forth, whereas something like dignity is hard to measure or quantify. So I guess I wanted to ask you how do you define dignity what does it mean for someone to have dignity and when they have it or they don't?
Right. Well, thank you. And that's the bulk of the problem in many ways, is it's not definable. It's kind of like the old, you know it when you see it, or people know it when they have it or when they think they have it. And so consequently, I think we tend to forget that it's important to people. I think the people have a better chance of understanding when people are denied dignity. You know, it's kind of the opposite of being denied dignity is humiliation.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of how I came up with the title, was realizing that a lot of what I wrote about, which was drug addiction, angry politics, homelessness, it was a result of people feeling humiliated in some ways and wanting dignity. In terms of how I define it, I think the phrase I use as a longer phrase is, I think everybody kind of wants to feel like a valued member of something larger than themselves.
Yeah.
So it's very much defined by the community and feeling a valued member of that community.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I try to emphasize as well in these conversations is people want dignity, but the quest to get it doesn't always end well. It's not always something that, you know, there are people who try to get dignity in things that are quite profane and quite awful. You know, they try to find, for instance, you know, there is a sense of, one of the things I think it's hard for me to try to explain to people because it's so stigmatized, is there's actually a dignity in drug use in some ways, in the sense that when you go in the crack house, it's a very welcoming place if you use crack. And so I think there's a lot of people who join that because they feel like they're a dignified member of a community that we don't view as being dignified, but within that community, you can have your role. You know, you can be somebody who has a very valuable place within that community, and that's how you find dignity. And I think one of the things, you know, to the larger point about the quantitativeness, you know, given my background, which was, you know, again, everything I did for roughly 30 years prior to writing this book was focused on the quantitative, both as a physicist and as a trader. And I think, you know, if you had asked me then 20 years ago in the middle of it all, what I would, you know, like if I had said to myself, if you had said to me, I think we need to think about public policy and frameworks that help people provide dignity, I would have laughed. I said, you can't define it, so it's not important. That's not our job.
Yeah. And
I think that's entirely wrong now. I think that old way of thinking is just entirely wrong.
Yeah. One of the things, I mean, you were just talking about like a crack house, for example, but in the different kinds of places and not institutions, but the places where you find people, McDonald's, church, and so on, and the contrast between that and the kind of institutions like the courthouse and so forth. I thought it was interesting that the people that you talk to, I mean, there's a very clear sense of, you know, people have this very clear sense of right and wrong and a very strong moral values. And then they confront the fact that when they go into kind of front row America, or when they encounter front row America, that they receive a judgment, or that they're judged in a negative way, not so much in like this moral sense of good and bad, but that they're just kind of judged and like written off or rejected as people in a way that produces that kind of humiliation that you mentioned a minute ago. And I guess I was just trying to think about how like it seems like on a person-to-person basis, it's possible to have these kind of, you say, well, look, like you're doing the, you know, you're doing this, you're doing drugs, and it's not going to help you, and it's going to harm you, and you can have that personal relationship with someone. But when someone who's struggling with that encounters like the system or the whatever society has set up to deal with it, it's just a really kind of hurtful kind of rejection. I'm not sure where I'm going with that, just the kind of contrast between the individual relationships and the kind of institutional thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of what I would reframe it as, one of the things that was very eye-opening to me over the 8 years of, quote, you know, basically spending time with, to use a word they use to describe themselves sarcastically, losers,
yeah,
is how badly we, our system, who intends to help them, helps, yeah, them. Meaning, yeah, you talk about the institutions. I mean, I write about places that are just drab, have linoleum floors and fluorescent lighting, and
yeah,
this whole is to put it in, again, a hard to define word, they just don't have soul.
Yeah,
and yeah, I think people feel that, you know, it's just this, it's this, it's, they feel like everything that's there to help them.
Yeah,
the nonprofits who are, again, I don't want to complain about nonprofits because they're wonderful, yeah, and I don't want to but all the institutions that have kind of out there to try to help people who are struggling are just dreary and drab, and it people feel judged when they enter them.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, one of the things that I talk a lot about McDonald's role, and
yeah,
part of the reason people, quote, losers use McDonald's is because you're not judged there.
Yeah.
And, you know, people push back saying, well, what about libraries? They serve the same population, the homeless, the people, you know, who are struggling. And that's true. And I love libraries. And my mom was a librarian for 40 years, but they just feel, people feel very judged when they enter a library. Like there's just a, yeah, set of rules. Libraries at least have a lot more warmth than let's say, you know, some of the other nonprofits. Yeah. But again, it's one of those things where I think when I look at the bureaucracy that serves the poor,
yeah,
because of efficiency, you know, and because we've kind of made these places kind of dreary and drab, and we've removed the dignity. I mean, it's undignified in many ways to have to go to do these institutions. And, you know, I used to visit Rikers a lot because I had friends who would be spending in Rikers, and at every level of visiting someone in Rikers, you're humiliated as, yeah, a guest, you, yeah, know, and no one's going to spend the extra money,
yeah,
extra $10,000 to put proper lighting in the visitors area.
Yeah.
Because, you know what, all that in aggregate over time wears on you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm visiting somebody in Rikers who's just a friend of mine, and I'm doing it, you know, but I'm sitting there in the waiting room, and it takes about 6 hours to visit someone for half an hour in Rikers.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there in the waiting room surrounded by people who have families who are, you know, yeah, who, and just watching them have to go through this humiliation of 4 or 5 checkpoints.
Yeah.
And it's, and again, broken things, and it, again, it's very undignified.
Yeah.
And I wish there was a way, you know, if I say, like, you know, if someone tries to pass a bill saying we need to spend $100,000 for beautification of visitors' areas in Rikers, no one's going to pass that.
Yeah. That sense of soul. I mean, and this I think comes through so strongly in the photographs. The sense of a kind of place where people are at home and comfortable versus kind of, you know, the kind of fluorescent lights you talked about. I can absolutely picture that. I mean, speaking of things like the court system, well, I guess you mentioned before we started, the question of, well, how different people have received the book and your work. And I wanted to ask you about the question of, or really the whole question of kind of policy and politics, where like on the one hand, you can say that certain kinds of policies, for example, universal healthcare or whatnot, would really help a lot of people and might be really good. But then on the other hand, there are certain things that maybe policy can't really do. Like there are certain things that are maybe beyond the reach of the government doing this or that. And so I guess my question would be, and I know that you hold back in the book, you're not trying to offer a set of policy prescriptions or whatnot. But I still wanted to ask if you have a sense of how do you envision that there might be certain policies which would actually help, and yet there are things that are never going to be solved by policy.
Right. I mean, one of the things I try to communicate in my book is that I had two words on my computer when I was writing the book. One was dignity, to remind myself of what I was writing about, and the other was humility, which is to remind myself that I don't have the answers. Yeah. And you know, to try to not put myself in the book too much. That's why I purposefully left out policy, but also because I don't know.
Yeah.
but I do know what is wrong. Yeah. And you know, one of the things that's wrong is first of all, I believe in expanded social services. Yeah. I come from the left. I believe that I treat it as harm reduction. You know, if we can't solve the big structural issues, unless over time we can at least diminish the pain of being poor.
Yeah.
And that means for me, it's kind of like with addiction is harm reduction, which is helping people get more resources quicker. Yeah. But the larger issue I think is, you know, again, I don't know how we move to society, you know, which is almost a cultural issue of where we only value how much money you make or what your resume is. And that to me is the core message of one of my books, is that I think we have denied these kind of avenues of meaning that are predominantly used by the working class because they don't require a resume, they don't require credentials, and you know, things like faith and place, you know, that can give you that dignified role of being a community member or being a strong member of your congregation. Those things, we kind of only think of this because we have this meritocracy now, which is overvalues resumes.
Right.
You know, that kind of puts people who don't have a lot at kind of starting off in a bad starting off point. And so how do we go to a society that revalues kind of a local meaning versus one that kind of has a culture that it's almost like, you know, this, we have this intense materialism that, and I don't know how you change that. I mean, how do you get, you know, I didn't mention my book because, you know, it's very anecdotal, but I look back at my childhood, which was in a small working class town in the South. And believe me, there were a lot of problems. I mean, part of the reason we were there is because my parents were involved in civil rights. And so I understand what was very wrong with that time period.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a member of the community who, we basically had two factories in town, and they made orange juice. One of the owners of the factories was, everybody knew they were rich, right? You know, they owned a lot of land. But the kids went to high school with me. Like, you know, the kids worked in the groves. I mean, you know, they were members of the community who didn't flaunt their wealth. And, you know, eventually when the Fortune 500 list came up, they were in the top 500. And yet they lived in a nice house, but it was a normal ranch house, you know, and they were just part of the community, and they felt an obligation to the community at some level.
Yeah.
You know, fast forward 30 years now, and that factory is closed. It went through a series of, you know, they ended up being bought out by a Brazilian conglomerate. And the children of that family, their kids, you know, their kids go off to the private schools at Dalton and things like that. You know, they don't go to the local high school. Like, how do you change that?
Like, yeah.
You know, Like, yeah. How do you feel people need to, corporate leaders and quote the elite need to feel a obligation to the community and the country that I don't think they have now?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure New York is kind of an extreme example of that in some ways, but the thing about, I mean, just, and I know you weren't getting into it explicitly in the book, but I guess maybe about the kind of reception or the response to the book. I noticed, and I think you mentioned as well, that a lot of people on the right wing have been very receptive to some of the things that you're saying, perhaps partly because of these things like dignity and so forth. In spite of the fact that you personally would be more in favor of kind of left-wing policies and so forth. And on the other hand, there have been people on the left who've been critical of saying, well, maybe he's not emphasizing policy enough and so forth. I mean, is that an accurate way of talking about the response, or is it a little more?
Yeah. I mean, I was actually shocked by the response. I thought I had written what was, I mean, I thought something of a Marxist book. I was really struck with, you know, part of it is my fault in terms of advertising, I suppose. But I think what it came down to was, I think, first of all, there are two answers I think that are a little bit more than just petty. One is, I really do think there's a shift going on where parts of the right are really rethinking how they approach economic policy.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe I'm being fooled by that. Maybe maybe I'll wake up 5 years from now and realize they're, quote, I'm being used, or my book's being used to buy votes. But I do think there is this real rethinking on the right of like, oh my, you know, we've embraced these libertarian policies. That's not really what we as a nation are supposed to do.
Yeah.
So I think there's that. And I think the other one was, I mean, quite honestly, where I disagree on the left were, I mean, I did come up with some disagreements with my past self, which was, it's more the technocratic left, where I would say that, you know, the neoliberalism or whatever tag, yeah. where I've really pivoted from, and where I think who have been most offended by my book or just ignored it. Because, you know, because again, I don't think a targeted tax credit is a solution to poverty. Yeah. And I'm very strong. And so I really do have I really have changed in that sense. And to the degree that that part of the left has a strong voice in currently. But the third thing, and I was only going to do two, but a third is, I think it's how I approach faith. Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't know why it's become almost profane in some quarters of the left to talk about the role of faith and the importance of faith. I mean, I do know why, and I understand the arguments about that, but I also, this is a deeply religious country.
Yeah.
And if your goal is to win elections, you have to understand that. And certainly a lot of the Democratic base is deeply religious. I mean, you know, you just go to Selma, Alabama, but I change. I really do think faith has a very important role. And I think that right now is controversial on the left.
Yeah. Yeah. That part, the question of faith, I thought was extremely interesting. And there was, I think this is a quote from the book. I didn't put a page number, but I think you wrote, quote, "With a great job and a great apartment and a great neighborhood, it's easy to feel we have nothing for which we need to be absolved. The fundamental fallibility of humans seems outdated and distant. It's not hard to imagine that you have everything under control," end quote. Whereas the people that you meet know that that's not true. They know that we don't have everything under control, and that we don't, like, that human, like, my will and my reason isn't capable of solving everything. But I know that, I mean, and you've written about kind of your own experience from childhood through kind of adulthood and how you'd evolved. I guess when you started the book, you would have said definitely you're an atheist, and maybe kind of changed a little bit over the course of this experience. But I wanted to ask, what, like, if you were talking to like a front row person, or let's say, you know, one of your colleagues or neighbors in formerly in Brooklyn or a place like that, who's very skeptical about religion, what would you tell them? I mean, how would you respond if they say, well, I think religion is just kind of a deception or distraction? I mean, what do you say to people who say that?
Right. I mean, I have a bunch of different approaches, depending on who that person is. Right. But the general thrust is I will go with the more pragmatic argument, which I think is also a slightly unfair argument, but the easiest for the front row to understand, which is religion works. You know, there's a reason, like we talked about initially about the kind of undignified spaces people have to operate in. The exception is churches. You know, the people who've gotten out of addiction that I know, it was only through the church that they did so.
Yeah.
And you know, it really is something that works.
Yeah.
You know, now I think that's an argument that's very kind of almost condescending to religious people, because it says, you know, they need the opiate of the masses, so to speak.
Right.
So I think my view is beyond that. And so if I'm trying to argue beyond that or discuss beyond that, I say, look, the evidence for faith, to me, and again, I'm on weak theological grounds because I'm not a theologian, but for me, that quote is what religion to me is about. Faith is about a humility.
Yeah.
That understanding that there are things bigger than us, and that we can't solve everything.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's easier to come to that understanding.
Yeah.
When you're actually struggling, because you can understand, you know, or it's easier to delude yourself as a wealthy person or a successful person or as an educated person to think we can solve this, you know, and at a very more technical level, you know, when I was a physicist, you know, I did the really hard stuff, the really deep stuff, the Big Bang, sort of things. And I could even argue that, you know, look, that's lacking too. You know, that really hasn't solved the deep metaphysical questions that I think a lot of lay people think it's solved.
Right.
You know, it still leaves a lot unanswered, and it won't ever answer that, I don't think.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to understand that, you know, I'm not my own particular faith or my own recognition of faith is more about, you know, in a scientific way, is recognizing that there's an error bar out there and it will always be an error bar. And we have to accept that. And perhaps faith is as good an answer to that error bar as anything that science can do.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I was really interested in the way, I mean, obviously covered a lot of ground, many, many, many thousands of miles. But just kind of following along in the book, thinking about the difference, some of the difference in the different places that you went to, like for instance, in both Selma, Alabama, and in Milwaukee, you know, you spoke to Black people who talked about the experience of racism in both places. And, you know, these are two very, very different places, but there's that common thread. And then I think it was in Amarillo, there was a story. I think there were three friends, Black, white, and Mexican guy at McDonald's who were all talking. And I thought, oh, that's great. Like there's at least one place where people can cross that boundary of race and have a real friendship. And then I was thinking about where you started in Hunts Point, which is, you know, literally a short subway ride from some of the wealthiest places on the planet, as opposed to Cairo, Illinois, which is 40 miles from the nearest Walmart. And I guess I just kept thinking, well, there's so many different parts of the country that yet all seem to suffer from this real abandonment of the back row by the front row people. And so I thought, well, I was curious if there is any place you went to, and I know you do mention it a few times, but are there places that you might think of where there's a little, like where the community is strong enough that it feels like the front row hasn't just walked away? I mean, I know you were kind of in a sense seeking out the places that had been abandoned.
Right.
But,
Yeah, you know, I mean, if it's places that work for the back row.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, 7 hours to your west, El Paso, Texas.
Yeah.
Is, you know, probably the one town I spend the most time in that I didn't write about was El Paso, because it's one of my favorite towns, because it, you know, it works at some level. The amount of drug addiction you see is not there.
Yeah.
You know, I guess it's the first ward, which has such great, such intense poverty, but there's still community there.
Yeah.
There's still a sense of, you know, and so it was basically Mexican American immigrant communities were doing very well. And the, another one was East LA, in Downey, where I think there's a sense that, you know, I've always thought if somebody wants to refute my book, they should, or if I wanted to refute my own book, I would write an essay about East LA or El Paso and how things work. And how people are relatively okay, and they don't feel as humiliated. And I think the question is why are those primarily newer immigrant groups that that are the case of that? In terms of, you know, the racism issue is one where, like, you know, some of my favorite towns are places that are very diverse. Yeah. And some level, you know, one of the things that frustrates me is a lot of the places we in the front row kind of mock, like McDonald's and churches and Walmarts, can be pretty racially diverse. Yeah. You know, if I want to find, you know, the immigrants in a community and talk to them, I go to the Walmart. You know, that's where everybody hangs out together. Yeah. So that's where people largely peacefully coexist. Yeah. But the frustrating thing at McDonald's I found was there were a few instances where it wasn't the case, but in general, the regular tables were segregated, not by McDonald's, but just by self-selection.
Yeah. Yeah. There was, you know, I thought reading the book as a white person, you know, and I thought, well, these, you know, like, it's really good for me to hear some of these Black people talk about their experiences with racism and the, you know, the kind of the subtle, especially in the North, you know, like it's easy for people in the North to say, well, like racism is a Southern problem, but it's really not. And just kind of in a very direct upfront way here, Black people talking about how racism has affected their lives. And I really noticed there was the part when you were in Cleveland and in Parma, Ohio, right around the convention when Trump was nominated, and people were very upfront about the role that racism plays in the appeal. And then you also, when you went over to Parma, kind of the more white working class community, and it was and they were like, you know, the people who were talking there were very upfront, like it was quite clear to see how and why Trump would have an appeal and why people in the white working class would vote for him and support him. And it was almost this kind of tragic sense of like, you can see where this is going and you can see why it's happening, and there's going to be some, you know, it's going to have some serious negative effects, but it almost seems inevitable at that moment that it's going to turn out that way. I guess going back to the question of how people have responded to your book, it seems like there are people who have noticed that you give a sympathetic portrait of the white working class, and then almost say, well, like, that's, you know, that's not fair. You're excusing racism or excusing Donald Trump. And it's like, they didn't read, they just skipped over the whole part of the book where you're talking about Black communities and racism. And I thought, that's just so strange. Like, how can you read this book and not see that it's focused and it's very upfront about racism? So I don't know what my question is, but I just thought it was strange that people would just screen that out when you're so clear. About.
Right. I mean, the idea that this book about Trump voters is probably the most annoying.
Yes.
And I think that plays into the question why the left might have been harsh on the book, because we didn't read it. I mean, like I said, there's a chapter called Racism.
Yeah.
And 65% of the voices in the book are minorities.
Yeah.
You know, the, and, And the bulk of the people in the book didn't vote. That's the biggest block.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it is frustrating. I mean, you know, I think at one level, when I get frustrated in that direction, I try not to push myself into views I don't have, which is, you know, these people who are complaining in that direction, I largely agree with on other issues. So it's I don't want to become somebody who ends up defending Trump voters just because I'm being told that's what I'm doing. Look, I think one of the frustrations I have is, and this goes way back to 2016 when I was doing my work in 2016, is if you're on the left, the left rightfully has called out the right when it portrayed working class blacks in atavistic terms. It looked at them as a group and explained their behavior because they're lazy or violent or something also just disgustingly awful, which isn't true. You should never label a group something. If your explanation for group behavior isn't political, isn't about the context in which they're operating in, as opposed to some personal failings, I think you're doing it wrong. And I think that's what being on the left means in many ways. So when 2016, when they started looking at the white working class, the left started doing the same thing of looking at the white working class and viewing it in this kind of ugly behavior.
Yeah.
As, you know, I happen to, you know, I don't think racism, except in a few instances, is this binary quality that is either on or off. I think it's something that is reflective of the times. It's reflective of the situation, and people can become racist and they can become unracist. People, you know, it can be a result of the political situation people operate in. And one of the points of my book is if you take away faith and place from people, you take away these things that give them, there's another one out there, which is racism. And that's the worst of the three. I'd much rather people be proud of living in their town than be proud of their race. And I think that's the danger we face, is if we take away faith and place from people, you know. And so I treated my book as a warning. If you don't like racism, which I think there's nobody who likes it, you know, then we got to change, because the system is built to encourage it, you know, in a way that I think is very dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you, and the photographs are obviously are really amazing, and maybe it was in the New York Times in 2012 or some of the pieces that you published, I started seeing the photographs from Hunts Point and so forth, and they're really, really powerful photos. So I wanted to ask you, kind of from the craft or technical side of as a photographer, how you approach, I mean, how you go about relating to someone who's going to be the subject of a photograph and making the photograph, and kind of how you see what you're after as a photographer.
Right. I started as a photographer first and a writer second. So I'm very proud of my photos. So thank you. I used to say that I try to take dignified portraits of people who don't usually are given that opportunity, you know? Yeah. And so how I do that, or how I try to do that at least, is spend a lot of time with people. Like, and also I never take a picture without somebody's fully being on board with it. Meaning I don't shove a camera in someone's face without us talking for a few hours and making sure that they're cool with that. And that they want to be involved in this process, you know. And the Bronx, that was a 4-year process. The pictures came out of 4 years of spending time with people. Yeah. On the road, it was a little bit less time. Sometimes it was 20 minutes. But we always, you know, the photo always came last. It was always, you know, done in a way. And I think one of the things is hard for a lot of people, people are always shocked to find out. And maybe, you know, then it makes sense, as a lot of people I'm taking photos of don't generally have dignified pictures taken of them.
Yeah.
You know, they're homeless, they're dirty. And one of the things that, you know, I remember getting criticized for this at one level a long time ago, of letting them control how the picture is taken. So that means, you know, and sorry to be stereotype here, every female before the picture's taken goes in the bathroom and cleans up. They do their hair, they put on makeup, you know, and I allow that, meaning and people care about how they look. And so respecting that process is part. And so in that sense, I think some real inside photographs, people say, well, you're not doing true photojournalism. You're allowing people to be involved in the process of how the picture is taken. And I'm like, okay, fine. Then I'm not doing that. That's so be it. I think another thing I do is, and this is very inside photograph as well, is it was very important to have a digital camera because I used to shoot on film, but a digital camera, I travel very lightly. I keep my camera with me and that's about it. No light, yeah. No artificial light. And I allow people to delete their photos if they don't like them. So you can immediately look at the photo after being taken and they can delete them. And I fully give them the power to do that, to look through the pictures. You know, let's say I took 60 pictures of them. They sit down for 5 minutes and scan through and delete the ones they don't like. And, you know, believe me, there are some really, quote, great photos that I had to let be deleted.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's the right thing to do, you know. It's giving people the power to control how they're viewed.
Yeah. I could tell somehow, you know, that I mean, without knowing kind of that backstory, like it's clear that the sense of agency and I don't know ownership that the subjects have. I was curious if there either photographers or writers. I mean, I know there's all kinds. I know people mention Walker Evans and James Agee and Let Us Now Praise Famous Men from the Depression era and so forth. Just curious, again, either writers or photographers, if there are people who you've really admired or either present or historical, whose work you think is really worth checking out or studying.
It's interesting is I intentionally didn't look at other people's work.
Yeah.
Because then you start becoming, you start falling into this trap of knowing what came before you and trying to copy it, trying to do something differently.
Yeah.
And so it ends up, you end up not being able to be in the moment, if that makes sense. Yeah. There are photographers out there who I think, I can never pronounce his last name, and it's embarrassing because I'm quote friends with him. Is Tony Fushi? He's in Canada. He did a similar series on heroin users, and he's much more artistic. He uses a medium format camera. He does a lot of lighting, but you know I respect how he operates. He spent decades doing that, of getting involved with people's lives. I think the big difference is getting involved with people's lives. In terms of writing, it's just going to sound entirely off base, but the person who I read the most in terms of, quote, for inspiration, as it were, was a writer by the name of Roberto Bolano, who wrote the book 2666, which I probably read 15 times over the process of doing this project.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I'll try to connect that in a backhanded way, which is he writes about complexities of life and he writes in a very simple, almost journalistic framework.
Yeah.
And he just really writes simply. A little flourishes here and there, but he writes about experiences and the normal life of people. And if your readers or your listeners know 2666, it's five different books cobbled together.
Yeah.
It's the fourth book of the third book, which is the one where the listing of the deaths, which is basically Juarez. And that's partly why I went to El Paso was to spend time in Juarez, because of that book. But, all these awful murders happened in Juarez during the late 80s, early 90s. And I think it's the fourth chapter, I believe, where I think it's like 400 pages where he just writes maybe, I think 500 or 600 separate examples of people who died, their stories.
Yeah.
And it's a combination of both in the process of doing it, and it's hard to read because it really, it's a punch to the gut. Yeah. But it's effective because it both makes you realize the scope of what happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the individuality of each one.
Yeah.
So it takes you, it gives you both a sense of how, for, you know, 10,000 people were murdered, or 8,000 people were murdered, 5,000 people were murdered. That just becomes a number. But when you talk about, when you actually write 500 examples of it happening and give each one a short story, basically,
yeah,
and then put them together, you get a sense for both. That's a big number.
Yeah.
And it does, and you don't get lost in the idea of, like, it's easy to, it's almost easy to, like, a tragedy where 2,000 people die is almost, you know, easy to forget because it's just a lot of people. And yeah, he really makes it both personal and then gives you the scope of it. And that was kind of what I was trying to do by setting off and documenting people's stories, is give you so many people, but each one turn them into a person.
Yeah. That's, that made me think there's actually I don't know if you've been to Dallas recently, but there's actually a kind of bookstore here that's named after, the name of this place is the Wild Detectives, because they're fans of him. And anyway, yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm a much bigger fan of, like, I like the Savage Detectives, but
yeah,
I've actually read every one of his books at this point. And it's interesting, as you made me think, is, like, speaking of El Paso, like, it was about a year ago where I literally spent 5 weeks in the McDonald's in El Paso reading 2666. Wow. That was, you know, 100 yards from the border.
Did you go over the border at all when you were there? Or?
Yeah, all the time.
Oh, back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. So I used to go into Juarez pretty regularly. Which is partly, again, why I love El Paso so much, is you got the, I don't know if it's harder to cross. I'm presuming you can't cross right now because of COVID, but I think there's 4 pedestrian bridges. I used to, you know, just go to Juarez often.
Yeah. I was, it was interesting to me that, citing him as an example, because I was, one of the things I'd followed was, this question of journalism and kind of like the quote unquote, the rules of journalism. And I was thinking, you know, personally, like, I was asking myself why I responded so much more strongly to your work than to quote unquote normal journalism. And I realized it's because, I mean, it's like, if I'm looking in the newspaper or a magazine, a typical news story about a place, like a kind of back row America place, like, I realize it seems to me that it's always about, there's an agenda, there's a narrative, there's just, like, in 2 paragraphs I can tell, okay, what's the angle here, what's the message that they're sending. There's good guys and bad guys, there's a problem, there's a solution. Every piece of information is kind of crafted to fit into, like, here's the issue that's being talked about and what we should do about the issue. Whereas what I found appealing about this book, about Dignity, was seemingly that it was really not like that. It was just more about what's going on, like, what are people thinking about, like, what is life like? And it somehow just felt, as a front row reader, I was able to kind of somehow get into it, or it seemed like it was better able to at least a little bit see something about how they were seeing the world or what their life was like, more so than if I'm reading something in the paper about, like, the opioid epidemic or whatever. So I thought, well, maybe it's good. Like, I really like that this is not following, like, the normal rules of journalism, because I think it's better, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And that was intentional. I think, going back to the influences, I think, I can't pronounce her name. It's really embarrassing. She won the Nobel Prize, actually, she won the Nobel Prize in 2015. Svetlana Alexeyev.
Oh, okay, okay.
Belarusian journalist, who actually, her books are just stunning. I mean, I feel embarrassed to just say I would like to be like her, because she's just so much better. But she wrote a book called the one that I guess won the Nobel Prize what's the recent one? I'm trying to Google it to remember to find out. Secondhand Time, The Last of the Soviets.
Okay.
And what she does is similar to Bolano, but she's a journalist, where she went collecting stories for 20 years, and then she puts them together in this book, and she turns her interviews. So she uses a little bit of artistic license, which I love, but she turns the interviews, which are dialogues, into monologues. Yeah. So she takes herself out of it. And so she tapes these interviews with people, and then she rewrites them as monologues. And so it's really an effective process by which, you know, I'm sure a strict journalist would say, you can't do that, you know. But it really is much more effective, and it gives you the realization that it's not about you. The journalist is about the actual people involved.
Yeah.
But what I would like to do is, you know, along those lines is, one of my frustrations is when I read a journalist thing, what I roll my, again, this is very pet peeve, but when I roll my eyes at when they tell you the exact name and age of everybody.
Right. Right.
And one of the things is like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like that's not essential.
Yeah. Like, you don't ask people when you meet someone, like if I meet somebody, I don't ask them, so how old are you? Like, it's just,
and you know, and I actually feel like I wish I had done less of that. I changed a lot of names, and I changed a few small details to protect people because they were involved in some, you know, illegal activity. But I would rather, if I did another project, was effectively fictionalize people from real experiences like Bolano did. Like, he takes these real experiences and he turns it into fiction, partly to protect the identity of the person, but also to get to the essential truth, right? All these, you know, there's a part in the book that, perfect example, this small example, there's a part in the book where I meet this couple who are in a shopping cart. I mean, they have kids in the shopping cart. It's important myth in Ohio. Yeah. And I met them in a Burger King parking lot, but 99% of the rest of the action took place in a McDonald's parking lot 75 yards down the road.
Right.
My editor insisted, and I understand why, that I include the detail of Burger King, but it made the flow of the narrative really complex. I literally spent 3 days trying to write it in a way that, you know, wasn't jarring to the reader.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that I met them in the Burger King parking lot didn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this isn't forensic explanation of what happened. It's the fact that they had two kids in a shopping cart and were homeless.
Yeah,
and they spent most of their time in a McDonald's parking lot. The fact that they were 3 days earlier in a burn, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
but that's something you have to do in journalism. You have to quote focus on the facts, which can be trivial.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering. I know that a few years ago, when you wrote the book, you described kind of your experience being in a fairly upscale place in Brooklyn amongst kind of the New York City people who are kind of, you know, doing very well and so forth. But you then did move after you left banking, you moved to a smaller town outside New York City. And I was kind of curious whether your experience, I guess you've been there for a few years now, being in a smaller place, like, gave you a different perspective on any of this stuff or.
You mean where I live now?
Yeah, yeah.
Getting out of New York helped. I think, you know, where I live now was more convenient for my family. I would actually be in El Paso or Reno if I could live anywhere. But my town is a small college town. It's New Paltz.
Yeah.
It's got a state university here, but it's also got a lot of, you know, it's really interesting town. It's like literally half the town voted for Trump, the other half didn't.
Yeah.
It's very much split into the back row, front row framework.
Yeah.
And so I see that on my daily, you know, the college kids and people associated with it's like I can almost, you know, I can unfortunately, I can label someone from the minute I meet them if they are affiliated with the college or not. And from that, I'm going to know a lot about them. Unfortunately, it's the book cover thing. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's being in New York City is, look, I love New York City. I was there for 22 years, but it can be very, it can give you groupthink.
Yeah.
You know, one of the hardest things and people don't like to hear this, is one of the hardest things for me, who grew up wanting to live in New York City more than anything.
Yeah.
Is when I finally got there, realizing that it was a pretty provincial place,
right?
that it was in many ways, you know, there's this old John Prine song that I think he does a cover of, in a town this size, I think it goes, when you smoke a cigarette, they'll be talking about your breath. And New York City is a small town in a very weird way.
Yeah. I wanted to mention, I can't remember, I don't think I mentioned in the introduction, but for those who are listening, I think that your Twitter feed is really interesting. I've learned a lot, and I know you've been doing writing for some different places recently. So everyone who's listening should definitely follow Chris Arnotti on Twitter. But I also wanted to ask if there are other people who are just out there, writers or whatever at this moment, whose work you'd recommend to people, or just kind of for other perspectives or deeper insight.
I mean, in terms of non-US stuff, it's the woman I mentioned.
Yeah.
She does amazing stuff. I think on the left, I think I get probably attacked for this, but I think people like Lynn Greenwald do pretty good stuff.
Yeah.
The Intercept in general, I think, has done a pretty good job of looking at this moment. In terms of people on the right, I actually find myself more welcome in intellectual right circles these days, which I find very frustrating. And I'm writing for the American Compass now.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm doing that is it's a bunch of right leaning former GOP people who, I mean, I can't believe I'm, but I feel like very much like it's more valuable. My time is more valuable trying to convert people than preach to the choir. Yeah. But in terms of people in the US, I need to think about that actually, in terms of who I think it gives good perspectives. I think, certainly with what's going on in the country right now, with these protests, I think there's some good stuff being done in both the Atlantic and the Washington Post. I find the New York Times to be insufferable these days, but I think the Washington Post does a much better job of covering the situation. I have to admit, I watch Tucker Carlson every night, not because I agree with him, but because that's what 60% of the country agrees with.
Yeah.
And, one of the things that helped me understand the rise of Trump was the fact that I put 400,000 miles on my car, and I don't have a CD player or Sirius radio, so I listen to local radio.
Yeah.
And listening to Rush Limbaugh,
yeah,
which I've listened to for 20 years, hating it, believe me, yelling at all the time, made me understand that where this movement came out of, and sadly wasn't surprised that it happened.
Yeah.
The other thing is, by the way, is honestly, sorry, is sports talk radio is another great way to kind of keep up with what, for lack of better words, normies, and that's the thing I like about Bolano is he writes about normies, it's like, right. One of the things I ended up doing during my trips was spending a lot of time just hanging out in Applebee's, watching sports and, just hearing people's. There's a vast part of America that just wants to pursue their hobbies and be left alone.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to, I don't know who's really writing about that, because it's not really, again, it's how do you write about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had, for anyone who's listening, I thought a couple of the pieces that you wrote recently at the American Compass were really great. There was one, I think it was something like, what about the bad culture of the rich? And, point like the kind of thing that you wouldn't normally read on a conservative outlet, but pointing out that, the so-called moral issues of poor people reflects at least as badly, or if not worse, on the people like who ran the banks and made bad decisions and didn't suffer consequences. And then I thought the piece also on how the kind of big corporations and big institutions are kind of co-opting or maybe co-opting Black Lives Matter is, you know, worth keeping an eye on. But finally, I just wanted to ask, in terms of your current projects, are you planning another book, or are you working kind of the same vein, or looking ahead to something different?
I was supposed to spend this summer, 3 months of it, driving around the United States, giving talks to basically anybody who would have me. And yeah. My rule was basically, it was smaller schools, community yeah. colleges, state schools, and libraries and addiction groups. And it literally was the day I was literally in my car. 15 minutes before I left on this trip, my first appointment canceled, and said, it was actually saying, look, we can't do this because of COVID.
Yeah.
So that ended. And then after that, I was going to go to, I was going to spend 2 months in India.
Oh, wow.
But I can't do that either. Yeah. So both projects were, the first project is basically, to the case of project, I mean, I don't do things as a project. I just do them, and then they end up being projects. So over the course of the 8 years of driving 400,000 miles around the country, there are places that stuck in my mind.
Yeah.
That I don't feel like I did justice to, or keep coming back and haunting me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I find myself always thinking about them, even though I might have spent 2 hours in them only.
Yeah.
And so I want to go back to those places and write almost like scenes from these places. And most of them are known for being kind of weird, and let, like, one of them is, I'm going to get the name wrong. Always forget the name. But it's a town, off of I-40, I think, in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
That grew up around a truck stops. And so now there are all the four big truck stops, the four big names, TNA, Flying J, mm-hmm. What's the other two? Petrol and I forget the other one. All have a truck stop there, Love's. And since then, it started with this intention of being transient. It's four big truck stops.
Yeah.
Now it's turned into a town where people live.
Yeah.
It, all affiliated with this truck stops. And so it's got this weird permanence, but both transience and permanence. And, you know, whenever I'm passing through, I always stop there and stay at the same hotel and go to the same church. And it's just this really odd place where I don't think anybody who lives there ever intended to spend their life there.
Right.
You know, because they were just getting a job at Love's. And
right.
then 30 years later, the town hall is literally a double wide trailer that was put up there probably 30 years ago with the intention of, like, you know, being more permanent, and it just it never happened.
Yeah.
And the other place is and especially relevant given what's going on with COVID was Fort Dodge, Kansas, which is a meatpacking town,
mm-hmm.
Which has a large Somali population, and it's between the Somali population, the Mexican American population, the old traditional white population, the fact that it always smells really bad, and it's also by sheer, for whatever reason, it's listed as the windiest city in America. So it's got this, like, it's got all these variables that make it kind of almost a hard place to live, but still have a strong sense of community.
Yeah. Well, our guest today is Chris Arnotti, and his book is entitled Dignity, Seeking Respect in Backrow America. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.